All right, Romans chapter 14 is where we're going to be. So if you will, look there. Romans chapter 14, we'll start off with verse 1. And I would like to just start by reading down from verse 13. The instructions are here to receive one who is weak in the faith, but not to disputes over doubtful things. For one believes he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat, and let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him. Who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. One person esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. He who observes the day observes it to the Lord. And he who does not observe the day to the Lord, he does not observe it. He who eats, eats to the Lord, for he gives God thanks. And he who does not eat, to the Lord he does not eat, and gives God thanks. For none of us lives to himself, and no one dies to himself. If we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. For to this end Christ died and rose and live again, that he might be the Lord both of the dead and the living. Why do you judge your brother? Or why do you show contempt for your brother? We shall all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. It is written, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall confess to God. So then, each of us shall give account of himself to God. Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore. But rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. Now, as we stop there for just a moment, I want you to note that verse 13 of the text actually serves as a slight transition to the remainder of the chapter, beginning in verse 14, going into chapter 5 and verse 7, when he says not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in our brother's way. It has reference to the way we're to treat one another despite the differences that we might have with one another concerning these matters under consideration today. So keep that in mind, because we'll use that as a means of jumping into the latter part of the chapter in just a few moments' time. Now, there are a couple of things to note, and I want you to keep these things keep these things in mind when we look at this particular passage. First of all, we have a situation in chapter 14 and verse 1 where there was apparently some strife that existed. We might even say division. I don't know that you could claim that division has not yet happened if there is one brother who is unwilling to receive another brother. The word "receive" there is the term proslambano, which is a Greek term which indicates that concept of fellowship. Reception is something that we do to one another as Christians. We are a part of a family. We are part of the same body. We are members together, one with another. By the way, when we look at that particular term, proslambano, the concept of reception is found in the major portion of that term, lambano. The word pros is a reaching out. It is something that actually strengthens that term. So what he's describing here is an effort that is to be made on our part to reach out and bring another to ourselves. That's the concept of fellowship that is found in this particular text. You'll notice he states that we're to receive the individual who is weak in the faith, and then he begins to give some examples of individuals who are weak in the faith that should be received. There are two scenarios that are mentioned in this particular text. If you'll notice, the first one is found in verse 3, the second one in verse 5. In verse 3, he says, verse 2, I guess, would be the best way to start it. He says, one believes he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. So we have an individual who is weak in faith, that the cause of a pang of conscience, and in fact the concept of the conscience is found in this particular text. You'll look, for example, in verse 23, going down just very quickly. He says, "He who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith." And so in verse 1 of chapter 15, "We then who are strong have to bear with the scruples of the weak." So this this idea of having a good conscience, that is, having your conscience in agreement with your actions. An individual who is weak in the faith with regard to the eating of meat, he is an individual that has a scruple. He has a pang of conscience that precludes him from being able, without guilt or without feelings of guilt, to eat meat. And so how are we to treat an individual who is like that? Now, the Apostle Paul in this particular context indicates that we're to receive that person. Despite the fact that whenever he contemplates eating meat because he thinks that it's wrong to do that, he has a pang of conscience or a scruple. That indicates that, let's just take as an example, if for some reason he was tempted to eat that meat and he succumbed to that temptation, he decided, okay, I'm going to eat this meat. When he eats it, he feels guilty because in his mind, he is convinced that it is wrong to eat that meat. And as a result of that, he, when he eats it, he violates his conscience. Okay? So that's what's under consideration. He's weak in the faith in the sense that the Apostle Paul reveals here, and does in other places as well. 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he does it very clearly. We can look at that as a companion text in a moment. But he reveals clearly that there is nothing wrong with eating meat. But you have an individual here whose conscience will not allow it. So what about that individual? There are two things that are mentioned here. You'll notice verse 3 of the text, continuing on, he says, "Let not him who eats despise him who does not eat. And let not him who does not eat judge him who eats, for God has received him." So let's look at the first one. So here is an individual who is strong in faith in this particular circumstance. In other words, he has that understanding that meat is nothing, that God does not care whether we eat meat or not, and so he is able to eat that meat. He looks upon the individual who has the scruple, who has the pang of conscience, and he despises him. And what that is, it is an indication of arrogance on his part, of a smugness. This individual is weak in faith, and as such, I have contempt for him. It's not the proper attitude to have for the child of God. Conversely, you've got a problem with the individual who isn't able to eat because he thinks it's sinful or wrong. It may be difficult for him as he has his own personal pang of conscience or scruple with regard to that to recognize the legitimacy of what Paul is here saying, that there's nothing wrong with it. And so there's a danger here because he can't see how it could be acceptable to God or right to do it, that if an individual eats meat, that he will not judge him. In other words, it's very difficult for him not to judge him, to say, "Hey, you're doing wrong. You're condemned. You're sinning as a result of what it is that you're doing." And so with regard to this particular scenario that's mentioned in verses 2 and 3, he gives the instructions as to how to treat one another. But understand this, he does so in light of the instructions or the explanation that he gives concerning that scenario. The eating of meat is something that is authorized by God. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing sinful about it. Now, if an individual cannot in good conscience do it, he's not violating God's law. In other words, it's not a requirement that you eat meat. It's a liberty. It's something you're allowed to do. You don't have to. So we should not look with contempt upon an individual or despise him if he's not able to do something that we have the authorization or liberty to do. But that individual, this perhaps is the most difficult of the two, the individual who is the weak brother, he has to recognize that despite the fact that he has this scruple or this pang of conscience in the matter, that there's nothing wrong with it, that Paul said, an inspired apostle said, there's nothing wrong with it. And if you can't do it, okay, but judge or condemn an individual who does have that liberty and who can exercise that liberty because he does not have that same scruple or pang of conscience that you have. So this is the scenario that is mentioned in verse 3 of the text. Now you go down to verse 5, there's a second scenario that is raised. He says in verse 5, one person esteems one day above another, and another esteems every day alike. And as I understand these things, it has reference to the personal practice of a Christian. These are individual matters that are under consideration here. And as to what that might be, we could give you an example. I don't know. There's no way of deriving from the context specifically what the practice was. There is an indication of things that were done. But let's give you just a scenario where an individual who is a Jewish Christian, where he might continue to observe certain of the feast days of the Jews, where another may decide not to. Now, there is a distinction or a difference between religious observance and a cultural observance in this regard. We need to keep that in mind. We must recognize, as the Apostle Paul said, and actually has emphasized this, we've studied this ad nauseum in our study, that the old law has been done away with. But at the same time, having said that, there remained the temple, and Paul himself underwent, which led to his arrest, for example, he underwent a rite of purification as a Jew, as a part or a practice to appease, actually, in an attempt to appease the Jews who were claiming that he was trying to do despot to the law. But having said that, again, we have a scenario here where you have two brethren who are differing with regard to some observance. One individual esteems one day above another. Now, if you want to set aside a day to observe a particular event or circumstance, or to, let's say an individual takes a particular day, chooses to use that particular day as a day of fasting, another does not. This is, again, something that in the text is a matter of liberty rather than commandment. And that's, I think, established clearly in the latter clause of the fifth verse. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. This, again, goes to the question of conscience. If an individual is going to esteem a day, then he needs, as he's practicing that practice, he needs to do so with a good conscience. He needs to be fully convinced in the righteousness of that action. If another individual chooses not to esteem one day above another, but rather to treat every day alike, then that individual likewise needs to be fully convinced, in other words, not have a pang of conscience, be conscientious with regard to that observance, and be able to do that with a clean conscience, a good conscience before God. So that idea of being fully convinced is found here, again, indicating this is something that is not required of God, but it is something that is allowed by God. And so that, even though there may be a difference there, what the same principle applies as stated in verse 3. If an individual is able to observe a day, or he observes a day, another, the way they treat each other is the same. Now, to establish the validity of this particular explanation, I do want to just spend a moment going over to 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And there are a couple of terms that I used. And I know, and by the way, we have studied this on many occasions. I recognize that. So I'm not necessarily desirous of spending several weeks in the discussion of the 14th chapter of Romans, as we have discussed this on many occasions. But having said that, we do want to give it sufficient explanation and answer any questions or entertain any comments you might have. I want you to notice in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the idea of meat eating is brought up again, or brought up on a different occasion. You'll notice in verse 4 of 1 Corinthians chapter 8, he says, concerning the eating of things offered to an idol, we know that an idol is nothing in the world and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. Now, what is he saying? So we understand, recognize that idolatry and the observance of rituals and sacrifices to gods, that it's not legitimate because there's only one God. We all understand this. And as such, understand this, that if food had been offered in sacrifice to a pagan god, then there is absolutely no validity, nothing in that at all. Nothing sacred, nothing special, nothing different about that meat, because those gods don't even exist. That's the point that he's making here. And so, as we know this, we recognize this, he said in verse 7, there's not in everyone that knowledge. Some have the consciousness of the idol, and until now, they eat that meat that was prepared. The eating of things offered to idols, verse 4. They eat that thing offered to an idol, and their conscience that is weak is then defiled. So they do something that they recognize and realize, or they think that they should not do. Now, Paul has already established there is no significance in regard to that meat. No religious significance at all, because idols don't exist. So he's indicating that there's nothing wrong with eating of meat, but for some individuals, because they have a pain of conscience or a scruple when they eat that meat, well, they defile their conscience. Now, for that person, it would be sinful, because he's doing something he thinks to be wrong. Now, I want you to think about this. It's a simple statement, and hopefully clear to everyone. If I think that I'm disobeying God by doing something, and I go ahead and do it anyway, at that point, it doesn't really matter whether it's actually something God would prohibit, because I am making the choice to disobey God. Now, it may be something God actually allows, but still, in my mind, I am disobeying God. I'm saying, okay, this is what I think God wants me to do, and I refuse to do it, or this is something I think God does not want me to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. And when I do that, then I am sinning, because I'm going against my conscience and doing something that I think that is sinful in the sight of God. So we have to be comfortable with the decisions that we make in this regard, regardless of whether something is sinful or not. So you have an individual who, he's still confused. He has the consciousness of the idol. And so when he eats that meat, because he has that weak conscience, he has that scruple, well, his conscience is defiled. Now, is that legitimately... it is disobedience for that individual, but inherently and legitimately, is it sinful to eat meat that has been offered to an idol? Notice verse 8 and 9, because this is where he establishes that it's not. He says in verse 8, food does not commend us to God. For neither if we eat it are we the better, nor if we do not eat it are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. Now, I always go to 1 Corinthians 8, 8, and 9 to describe the circumstances surrounding his instructions in Romans 14, because it gives us two ways of categorizing the scenarios that are under consideration in Romans 14. Notice verse 8, first of all. He said, food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat it are we the better, nor if we do not eat it are we the worse. Now, with regard to eating meats offered to idols, it doesn't matter to God. That's what verse 8 is telling us. God doesn't care. We aren't a better Christian if we eat it. We're not a worse Christian if we don't, and vice versa. So God doesn't care. It doesn't matter. So I've actually, and I know of some preaching brethren that have done the same, began to refer to the matters under consideration, 1 Corinthians chapter 8, And Romans 14, eating meat, observance of days, as matters of indifference toward God. It's kind of interesting that there has been some dispute as to whether that is a correct term, an acceptable term. The only argument that I've really heard against it is the argument that nothing is a matter of indifference toward God. The very hairs on our head are numbered. God cares about everything we do. Okay, well, that's a legitimate statement. God does care about what we do. And our very hairs on our head are numbered, so God cares deeply about us individually. But with regard to whether we're a meat eater or a non-meat eater, God doesn't care. In other words, he'll be as pleased with us if we eat meat as he is if we don't eat meat. That's what we mean when we say a matter that is a matter of indifference toward God. You are not sinning if you eat. You are not sinning if you do not eat. It is a matter of indifference. Okay? Yes?
Well, there's also, you know, he's addressing both your conscience as an individual and that potential stumbling block to others. Now, if I invite you and your family over to my house Thursday night, and you're going to ask me, then you're sitting there and saying, that's good spaghetti. And I say, yes. Every Thursday at the Catholic Church, that's a spaghetti supper. Sounds like a Lord of all supper. Now, all of a sudden, spaghetti didn't taste good. Because you think it might have been part of a false practices, property, and people who teach error. Same thing with these meat shops with idols. But now, if I know that you had come from a background of Catholicism, I know it's going to be a double offense to you. And I should be more cautious of your conscience in taking that kind of action. I mean, this is not an old dead issue, it's an issue today. If Mormons come over and knock on the door and they're invited in for study, they should offer a call to your team, knowing their practices. And the same thing with other cultures. You know, when you travel around the world, you're familiar with slight things that there's nothing wrong here, but it gives offense. You need to kind of be aware of those so that you can put your best foot forward and best influence.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And the principles that are under consideration here in this text can be broadly applied, certainly, in that regard. And what this ultimately comes down to, which is a point that I'll get to in a few moments in more detail, is this is the practice of love. This is the when you talk about the golden rule, which is an expression of the love that we should have for one another, is you should treat others the way you wish to be treated. That this idea is what I want to do in the decisions that I make is to ensure that by what I'm doing, I am not going to be disruptive or destructive to the faith or well-being, spiritual well-being of another. And this is certainly the case because the principle, as it is applied in Romans the 14th chapter, is directly applicable to my relationship with my brother in Christ, the other individual who is a member of the body and who stands before God. So, and we're going to be getting into that actually and talking about that in much more detail in just a few moments. I want to look at verse 9, however, and establish a second point with regard to the context and the scenarios. And the reason I'm doing this is because the principles that are established in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and in Romans the 14th chapter cannot be applied across the board in every scenario and every circumstance. And the Apostle Paul is not indicating that, where he's talking about to be careful how you treat an individual and be receptive to an individual and to be deferential to an individual in 1 Corinthians 8 and Romans 14. In 1 Corinthians 5, he's saying to deliver such a one to Satan for the destruction of the flesh. So we have to understand the extent and the realm upon which the context is in these verses. And that's what I'm trying to do with this reference in 1 Corinthians 8. So look at verse 9. So the first thing we saw in verse 8 is we're talking about something that doesn't matter to God. It's a eating of meat. You can eat it and be happy. You'll be fine. You don't have to eat it and won't be fine. And so the other word that is used in verse 9 is a liberty. Notice this. He said, beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. Now this concept of liberty is important as well. Let us make a distinction between liberty and commandment. When we talk about a liberty, it's something that God has authorized us to do or allows us to do, but He does not require it of us. So when we talk about attendance to worship in Hebrews chapter 10, that's a command. When we talk about our responsibility to partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week, that's a command. When we look at practice of pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father, it's not optional for us to keep ourselves unspotted from the world. These are commands. These are things that are required of us. but you don't have to eat meat. So, this is a key thing. If I have a brother who has a pang of conscience against doing something that God has commanded me to do, am I then free from my responsibility to do it? Let me just kind of throw out a scenario here. We talked about observing the Lord's Supper. If for some reason my brother in Christ, when we're in worship, and I know this makes no sense, but we're in worship later on this morning and we observe the Lord's Supper. And for some reason there's someone in the auditorium, a Christian, who says it's wrong or sinful to do what it is that we're doing. Should I then say, well, I'm not going to observe the Lord's Supper, I'm not going to remember the death of my Lord because my brother over here objects to it in some way? Well, of course, we have to do what God has required us to do. We don't have to eat meat. We can't eat meat, we don't have to. So if I get a situation now where I have a right to eat meat, but by eating meat, I cause my brother to stumble, I cause him to violate his conscience, to have that scruple or pain of conscience tempt him to sin, then I am using my liberty, as verse 9, as a stumbling block to the individual who does not have that same knowledge, but who retains the consciousness of the idol. And so now it gets down to how I am to conduct myself in relation to my brother. And it may be that though I have the authority from God, the liberty here in this text to engage in a particular activity, I will refrain from engaging in that activity lest by doing that I cause my brother to sin. So that's the way the Apostle Paul describes it in 1 Corinthians chapter 8 and 9. And the application can be made again with regard to the two scenarios, specific scenarios that are mentioned in Romans chapter 14. So let us go back over to Romans 14 and just again make note of the fact that as we look through the text into the 15th chapter and the 7th verse, 6th, 7th verse, that those are the two scenarios that are under consideration here. So I'm going to make two points or two statements in this regard that I think valid. And then we can enlarge upon it with regard to the concept of treatment as we go on beyond that. There have been for millennia, from the time in which individuals began to bring in innovations or to depart from the faith with regard to their teaching and doctrine, there have been apologists for such individuals, whether it be in the teaching of a false doctrine or the practice of a sinful activity, who have used the 14th chapter of the book of Romans as a rationale for differing with regard to those matters and yet receiving each other. In other words, maintaining fellowship despite the fact that error is being taught, maintaining fellowship despite the fact that sinful activity is being engaged in. Now, so having said that, there are a couple of points to make. Number one, I'm going to make it the two, and we'll open it up for any questions or comments you might have. The first one is that when you look at the context of Romans chapter 14, the only two scenarios that are listed in this particular text, there is no sin that is present or inherent in those actions, either the eating meat or the observance of a day. So contextually, with regard to the scenarios, there is not a sinful practice that is found in this context. Now, someone might ask a question, is the only two things under consideration eating of meats and observance of days, and you can't put anything else in Romans 14? No, I don't think that that is the case. I think that what you're talking about is a category or group of things that are matters of indifference to God, things that God authorizes that you can do, but He doesn't require that you do them. Those are the things that are under consideration. So if we have a difference between those things, you don't despise me, I won't judge you. You don't judge me, I won't despise you. I think I got both scenarios, both directions in regard to that, whether an individual is the weak or the strong in that particular instance. But since we do not have categories of sin or let me put this way, since we do not have scenarios that involve sin in the context of Romans chapter 14, for that reason, and one other that I'm about to note, I do not believe that you can use the 14th chapter of Romans to justify continued fellowship with an individual who is either teaching error, which is a sin, or practicing some sinful practice, doing something that God says is sinful and unacceptable. Okay? Now, that does not mean that I'm saying as soon as you see someone sin, you can't have fellowship with them anymore. There are any number of passages which deal with the proper things that we are to do and attempt in order to bring an individual to repentance and deal with sin that is present, short of not receiving that particular individual. We can talk about that if you'd like. All I'm saying is that the context of Romans chapter 14, what is envisioned here is two brethren involving themselves in a reception of one another. And by the way, this is an open-ended. There's nothing to indicate a time limitation with regard to this reception. And there's nothing to indicate that they are even to attempt to convince each other as to who's right and who's wrong. In fact, the opposite is true. In verse 1, it says not to argue about these doubtful matters, not to disputes over doubtful things. So, my contention is that since the context does not include the reception of any sinful practice or false teaching, then this scenario cannot be applied to sinful things. Okay? The second thing that I want to note is not only what we have indicated with regard to the two specific scenarios, the eating of meat and the observance of days, but that there are specific statements that are made in these passages which would preclude a discussion of sinful things. In other words, preclude the possibility that sinful things could be involved in it. Let me give you an example. Notice, first of all, in verse 4, it says, to his own master he will stand or fall. You shouldn't judge, because to his own master he will stand or fall in reference to God. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. But with regard to a sinful scenario, a sinful practice, that statement there, God is able to make him stand, is not one that would be accurate. It would be against God's nature. It is a righteous thing with God to visit his indignation and wrath upon those who are disobedient. Second thing, verse 5. He says, one person esteems one day above another, another esteems every day alike. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. Paul would not tell an individual to be convinced of the rightness of something that's wrong. And so, it cannot be wrong, or he would be telling them to repent, not to be convinced that you're okay. And that makes no sense, to tell someone, just be sure you're all right with it if he thinks that it's sinful, or God says that it's sinful. You continue on in verse 8. If we live, we live to the Lord. If we die, we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. So this is indicating that both the meat eater and the non-meat eater, the day observer and the non-day observer, is or belongs to the Lord. And so we're not to judge one another, verse 13, but instead not put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in a brother's way. So, having said that, point number one of our discussion is that whatever it is, whatever degree we can enlarge, or let's put it this way, whatever the sphere or context upon which the call to receive an individual extends, to whatever degree it extends, then we are to be receptive to an individual, and there are certain ways that we're to treat them. And basically, the two major points of this text, because we've been discussing this from the context of fellowship, is basically, we've got these divisions that are happening over matters that God doesn't care about. So I want you to do two things. I want you to receive them, and then I want you to make sure that the way you treat that brother is to treat him with love. Don't show contempt for him, don't judge him, and don't cause him to stumble. And that's more directly to the point as you get into verse 14 down through verse 7 of chapter 15. So there are really two things that I want to establish as true in our discussion this morning. First of all, that sin is not under consideration here, except in so much as you can sin against your brother about something that is not inherently sinful. Or you can sin yourself with violating your conscience about something that's not inherently sinful. But secondly, that there are certain ways that we are to treat brethren, and the ways in which we are to treat brethren are founded upon that principle of agape love, seeking their welfare. And I think that's what the chapter is about. Yes?
I'm just going to think, over the years, the problems that come up in the church, I can remember back in 1936, 37, when I was a kid, there's people thought it was wrong to play a game with dice, play a game with cards, couldn't cut out paper dolls, girls couldn't cut out paper dolls on Sunday. Basically, Sunday was considered a day of rest. Of course, now being raised in oil field, well, people work 7 days a week, around the clock and everything. But that stuff kind of weeded out. And then after down around Longview in East Texas and Gregg County, of course, there was church every 3 miles back in, when I was growing up. And everybody fellowship one another. And then we had the problems of the institutionalism and the church has been, and there was a new congregation started in Longview. My dad retired in 57. Well, they moved off from where the Grickton church and started going to this new congregation. Well, I had since grown up and moved to Fort Worth at that time. I went back and it was a custom in East Texas on Sunday morning that every woman wore a hat on Sunday morning. Sunday night, they didn't. When I went to visit for the first time at that congregation, I went on Sunday morning, every woman had a hat on. Sunday night I went back, and my mother being one of them didn't have a hat on, but the majority of them did have a hat on. And I said, well, what is this, a hair and hat congregation? And I asked my mother, I said, do you feel out of place? And she said, no. But what I'm the point I'm bringing out to that congregation, were made up mostly of real conservative brethren. But they did not have any problem over the women that did not wear hats during the service. They accepted one another. I never heard a sermon on it or anything. It was never mentioned. But like I said, the majority of the people in the congregation thought they ought to have a head cover.
Yeah, it's a. There are many issues that have troubled brethren over the years, and it's always a question as to whether sin's involved or not. And again, I mentioned at the beginning of our study, the more difficult position, I think, would be on the part of the weak brother, because he has that personal pain of conscience, and it would be very difficult for an individual who himself cannot in good conscience engage in an activity, nevertheless not to judge someone who can. That would be a very difficult step to get to the point. But I brought that out specifically because here in this particular text, the Apostle Paul has been giving explicit instructions with regard to the rightness or wrongness of the activity. He says there is nothing wrong with eating meat, and there is nothing wrong with the observance or the esteeming of the day. There's nothing wrong with it. So now you have an individual who personally has a problem with it, who's just been told by the inspired apostle there's nothing wrong with it. Now, he may still have a problem with it, but he no longer has a leg to stand on when he's telling his brother who's practicing that you're sinning by doing it and judging him in it, because Paul just said there's nothing wrong with it. So this is the point to be made with regard to, and you'll ask this question, deserve to be or belong in Romans 14 or not? Well, you don't go to Romans 14 to determine that. What you have to do is to go to find out whether it is sin, sinful practice. And sometimes that might be found in other places in the New Testament. In fact, most of the time would be. Is it sinful or is it not? If it is a sinful thing, someone is sinning when they're doing it, then you deal with it differently than you do in Romans 14 when there's no sin involved. And that's, again, we haven't gotten, you know, I spent a lot of time discussing these issues up to this point. We've only got a couple minutes left. So we've not gotten to the point to where all the arguments have been made and established. But that's the premise upon which we're basing this discussion, and we'll enlarge upon it next week as we continue. Yes.
So in my work history, I've traveled around different cities and stuff, and during the 90s, I worked quite a bit in Jackson, Mississippi, and a little bit in Bellingham, Washington. In those areas, like Jackson, Mississippi, it was nice. Sundays were relatively quiet. Most of the ladies dressed up. Most of them wore hats. But in those two towns I can think of, people looked down upon you. People would eat. If you mowed your grass, you were doing yard work on Sundays. So what is my overall impression of all the cities? I think people in Bellingham, Washington, Jackson, Mississippi are very respectful of other people's feelings. And I think when people expect to assemble with other Christians, they should also get that same feeling that I'm going to be treated with respect. My feelings matter. My viewpoints may be a little bit different, but I'm respectful of my neighbors. I'm respectful of other people's feelings, even when they don't agree with me. And I think when people come away from Christians, this is what I think from all this town. It's kind of like, I'm not going to go back. They treat me fairly. I know I don't say that I'm an outsider, but I'm treated well. And I would like to be around more people like them.
Yeah, I think there is a clash of cultures that's being discussed here in Romans 14 to a very great extent.
How you put those stumbling blocks in front of others, you're driving home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes, John.
I had a few weeks ago someone tell me when we were in a discussion on Romans 14, I'm tired of people just coming up with arbitrary lists on what's sinful and what's not sinful, and what's a test of fellowship and what's not a test of fellowship. Well, as you said, is it sinful or is it not sinful? And people get confused about that. People who are not studying do not understand this. If you want a simple formula to figure out whether or not it's sinful or not, you go to 1 Corinthians 8 and verses 8 and 9, because it's parallel complementary passage to Romans 14. And you plug in whatever you need to in there. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse if we do not, and no better if we do. Okay, let's talk about preaching. Preaching the whole counsel of God will not commend us to God. Well, okay, a little iffy at the first. We know it would commend us, but here's the further test. We are no worse off if we do not preach the whole counsel of God, and no better off if we do. Well, okay, we understand it would be wrong to not teach the whole counsel of God. So we understand if we don't, it doesn't plug in here.
Yeah, I use that same concept in verse 5 of Romans 14. Let each be fully convinced in his own mind. If you say you want the adulterer to be fully convinced in his own mind, well, that doesn't make sense. The Apostle Paul would say for the adulterer to be fully convinced in his own mind, then go ahead and back to your adultery. So that doesn't fit into this particular scenario or context. Yes, Mr. Rick, quick, please.
You touched on it, but the question we haven't answered, at least not in my mind, is what does that individual do, the weaker brother that you talked about, who finds himself in that position, and what you're doing, I think you're doing, is wrong. I can't do that. Okay, but then how am I supposed to decide that it applies in this situation or not? Now, you could tell me that Peter had a vision. You know, and Peter said, God told him it's okay to eat all these things. Now you can put that in my mind, and now I can give you the benefit of the doubt. I may not, my conscience won't let me do it, but I'm now willing to think that I can at least give him allowance for the fact that I may lack understanding. But that doesn't cover it.
Yeah. And we will need to talk about that more next week. But I do want you to note this, that just because the Apostle Paul said, don't judge the meat eater, doesn't mean that that weak Christian stopped judging the meat eater. In other words, he was supposed to. But I think this is a very, very difficult thing, and it's something we need to keep in mind. You know, these are the principles that he's setting out. Now, whether the principles are actually applied and practiced by the individuals he's admonishing, then that's somewhat questionable. But the fact is, Paul did say these things are okay. And so that's where this particular scenario lies. Okay, we didn't by any means exhaust the subject. There are certain things we have to talk about the text itself next week, and we'll pick that up next time. Thank you very much for your kind attention this morning.